Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Inside the universe lives your world. My world, many others, all connected. The man in black destroyed everything in my world. As long as he's out there, Earth will be next.
Death always wins.
I have to stop him.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, the gunslinger, Mr. Chad Riley.
Bang, 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 bang.
Chad
air
just...
reload. Bang, 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 bang. Belt air... reload. Bang, bang, bang. Good?
That's pretty spot on. As you can tell, we got a great show in store for you today, and we got a lot to talk about. The Filmlosophers is presented at the crux of the multiverse by Mingle Media TV and recorded live each week at VGB Studios. When you wake up from the land of dreams, you can find new episodes of The Filmlosophers each Wednesday morning on Google Play, Stitcher, iTunes, Libsyn, Audio Boom, and Player FM. Get your shine on by liking the show on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. Last but not least, you can access all of our previous episodes at vgbstudios.com alongside other amazing podcasts like Video Game Bang and Me, Myself, and I. I don't know if you know this, but Mike from Me, Myself, and I has been doing a lot of great stuff in the community lately, and he actually got Corey, the host of Video Game Bang, involved recently. If you don't know, check out the website. It'll have the links to all the Twitter pages and all the images that they've done. But Corey's actually gone out and handed water and food and whatnot to the homeless in the nearby area. So that's actually really awesome stuff. So kudos to those guys. And
yeah, that's awesome.
Hopefully we'll get a chance maybe after we're done serving up some charity to this movie review that we'll get a chance and hit the streets and do the same thing.
I see what you did
thing.
There.
Thanks. Yes. Ladies and gentlemen, you have been hearing about it all over social media. You have been hearing about it all over the interweb. YouTube has not been too kind. The reviews have not been too kind. And to be quite honest, I don't know if we'll be as kind either.
I mean, we won't be outright mean.
No, that's not the goal of this. The goal of this show is to kind of break down the great aspects.
You know,
the good aspects.
Just do an honest evaluation.
Yeah. And yeah, so you know what? We had a chance last week to check out this film, and let's just jump right in. We are talking about Stephen King's The Dark Tower. So, in this film, Roland Deschain, the last gunslinger, is locked in an internal battle with Walter O'Dimm, also known as the Man in Black. The gunslinger must prevent the Man in Black from toppling the Dark Tower, the key that holds the universe together. With the fate of the world at stake, two men collide in the ultimate battle between good and evil.
See, right there, that description sounds really good.
Well, see, and that description is...
I mean, what a cool promise
to
be making.
And that's kind of the similar promise that you can expect from, like, the actual book, from the resources where this film pulled from. Obviously, this is a Stephen King-based film, which Stephen King, if you've lived under a rock for the last 40 years, Stephen King is one of the most prolific horror genre writers of our time, and so a lot of his...
Well, and I think just most prolific in general. I mean, he's not, you know, got an army of, you know, helpers like a James Patterson or
Danielle
Steele or whatever that has a book every month because other people write half of them according to a formula. I mean, Stephen King writes all of his own stuff, as far as I know. I mean, he's like consistently publishing new material.
Constantly.
For decades.
Directed by Danish filmmaker Nicolaj Arcel, the film stars Idris Elba, Matthew McConaughey, Tom Taylor, Jackie Earle Haley and Catherine Winnick. If you're unfamiliar with the last name, Catherine Winnick, she's actually, Chad was the one who pointed out, she plays
Lagatha
on from
Vikings on the History Channel.
Yep. So Chad, that was one of the high points.
I was excited that she was in something other than Vikings. I mean, that's a great, it's a really good show. And she's a great character. She has a great character on that show. But
in the you're talking about the Vikings.
In Vikings, yeah. This film, it's a smaller part for her. She's the mother of the boy, kind of in the center of everything.
Yeah. I would have though, however, loved to have seen a little bit of that fighting action from the Vikings.
That's what I was expecting when I saw her. You know, you're introduced to his home situation and whatever, the boy, and you see her, and I was like, oh, is she going to throw down with somebody in this movie? That would be, you know, that would be the bomb. That would be amazing. But that's not how it plays out for her. She's not throwing down with anybody, really. She cries
quite a bit,
which is something that Lagatha rarely does on Vikings.
True.
Already we're deviating into other things.
We are, and that's maybe a telltale sign. Maybe it isn't. Who knows? Based on Stephen King's Dark Tower series of novels, which was inspired in part by Robert Browning's poem, Child Roland to the Dark Tower Came. This was a film that is actually, from what I gather from most people, this is supposed to be a continuation of sorts from the seventh book, I believe. The eighth book.
The film is continuing what's in the books? I thought that the film was adapting what's in the books.
See, that's the thing. That's part of the confusion.
He says, obviously, like, exposing to everyone the fact that he hasn't even picked up one of the books ever. Me. You have. I haven't.
No. I've only read, like, half of this series. And some people are talking and saying, oh, this is a continuation of one of the books, rather than this being an adaptation of one of the novels altogether, which one of them is called The Dark Tower. I believe that's the third book, because you have The Gunslinger, and then it's just, I don't know.
Now, you know, I was reading, so we went to Comic-Con a few weeks ago, and yes, one of the things that those of you who have the pleasure of attending Comic-Con and kind of circulating either inside or outside the show is you sometimes get free goodies. Like, you get free books or giant bags to carry things in, or every year you get a free Comic-Con special edition of Entertainment Weekly magazine.
Yes.
And this year's had, it was Atomic Blonde was the focus of it, with Charlize on the cover, but inside there was an article about this film, and they had interviewed the director, this Nikolai Arcel guy. And I think it was either he and his brother, or he and his best friend, or his cousin, or somebody. They had really heavily pitched to do it. And I'm pretty sure in the article, he was explaining that they pulled elements from two or three of the books and mashed them together into this movie as kind of a starting point for, because honestly, this is not, it's a really interesting thing that's happened here, in that it wasn't received very well, because we're not talking about, we're not just talking about a film franchise. This is designed and is moving forward as a film and television, like, multi-format crossover property.
Yeah.
Not that the characters are going to be the same in the TV show and the movies and whatever, but, like, the fact that it's made, that it is meant to be, in the novels, it is its own hub of a Stephen King multiverse, if you will. So, borrowing from that, they've envisioned this for years. I mean, they've been trying for years to get this thing greenlit and on the screen and drawing an audience. And for years they've been saying, well, there's so much material to work with that this could easily, immediately be more than just a film franchise. And that's the way they have it planned. And they are moving forward with at least one television series and another movie that may or may not be a direct sequel to this one.
And Chad isn't too far off in terms of the connectivity this story plays. The Dark Tower is actually, like we said, it's a series of eight books, and it actually spans an entire connective universe, which links several of the other books and stories by Stephen King, because Stephen King doesn't just do novels. He also does novellas. He does short stories. He does He's even dabbled in poetry. Mm-hmm. But some of those works include Bag of Bones, The Talisman, Black House, The Stand, Everything's Eventual, From a Buick, 8, Hearts in Atlantis. There's so many to really pull from there. So this film had a lot more on its shoulders than just being a successful adventure fantasy epic. This film, which is one of two films that are debuting this year that are adaptations of Stephen King's works, this film had the potential to ultimately bring back the Stephen King, or as some people have called it, the Stephen Kingdom universe,
mm-hmm.
Back to the forefront of
that's very cute.
I heard that today. Back to the forefront of cinema, and back to the forefront of a lot of people's, you know, TV screens and movie.
Sure,
screens.
I mean, many of his earlier books were quickly turned into film adaptations.
Some
of them have been done more than once.
As well as like TV miniseries, most of the longer formatted type films that a lot of people remember as like, you know, long movies, they weren't actually movies. They were actually TV miniseries, such as like The Stand,
right?
And there's plenty of them.
It was a miniseries?
Mm-hmm. It was a TV miniseries.
Oh, maybe that's why it was so terrible.
It was only a 4-part miniseries. Much like the
Yeah,
Stand.
And let's not talk about Under the Dome, because that was better as a book. I mean, most things are. Let's be honest. Most adaptations from book to something else, the book is always better almost every single time.
True. And this type of movie, this type of book actually had a lot going for it in terms of people had already shown interest in the fantastical epics such as Lord of the Rings, such as Harry Potter. You already have those types of films to kind of set the stage for the audience that this could have pandered to. It could have easily just walked in, did exactly what the books did, create this level of fantastical, you know, belief and you know, storytelling, and it would have done great to set the stage for things to come. It didn't do that.
Here's the thing. This is what I've been thinking about for roughly a week since we saw the film at a press screening.
Yeah.
And the thing that I keep thinking about is I feel like, so you can tell, you can definitely tell the way that the story begins, the way that it's structured, the musical cues. There are a lot of signals at the outset of this film that indicate, oh, this is myth-making. This is modern myth-making, and it's going to be a bit of a mashup because some of the story definitely takes place in the contemporary present-day world. You know, it's not like The Lord of the Rings, where it's all in a fantasy land, or Star Wars, where it's all in some future space, you know, area. The main character, who is this boy, your point of view character, he's in contemporary New York City. So, and there's considerable interplay between New York City and some of the places where the characters go that are not of our Earth in the film. And so there's every indication that this is going to be an interesting mashup of something like a Lord of the Rings. And then you've got, you know, that Western kind of touch to it as well because of, you know, the gunslinger, Idris Elba's character. And everything that he's about and where he's traveling through and all of that. But also you've got this very modern contemporary setting. So it's going to be a hodgepodge. And you know that from the outset. But the thing I want to say is it feels like they made a movie of the cliff notes of one or more of the books instead of a movie adapting any of the actual books themselves. It's like everything. This movie is done in an hour and 45 minutes. It's done. Yeah. After taking like 20-something years to be made and all this hype and some big-name actors in the two feature marquee roles, it's over in an hour and 45 minutes. And there's not really an abundance of stuff that happens in the hour and 45 minutes that you've got in the film. So to me, I was underwhelmed, I guess I should say, because I haven't read the books. I haven't read the graphic novels that Marvel put out a few years ago. I haven't really researched the storyline on Wikipedia or anything like that. I was expecting something a lot more robust than, what this turned out to be. And so by the end of it, I was like, it feels kind of flimsy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not really sold. I don't really know that it has the legs to keep going, because what happens in this film, I mean, we'll get to it eventually. There's a cutesy little, you know, wink near, you know, the in the credit sequence or whatever. But I mean, really, what happens in this film, it could totally stand on its own. And you wouldn't mind if it didn't continue. And that, to me, feels like they just sort of... There was no poetry to it.
Mm.
There was no real, like, nuance or complexity. It was just plot point, plot point, plot point, expected line of dialogue, plot point, conclusion.
Yeah. And I have to agree on a lot of that. The biggest thing for me is I am a Stephen King fan, so I've read a good amount of his works. I've seen most of, if not all of his films, even his, you know, appearances in like Creepshow and whatnot. And so I've been a fan of the man's work, needless to say. I'm extremely looking forward to it coming out later in September, and I'm still really working hard to convince Chad that he needs to come and see it with me.
Which, to deviate for a moment, also has a connection to history's Vikings.
Really?
Dude, the guy playing Pennywise is Floki.
Oh, that's right. It's Floki.
Yeah.
I didn't even think about that. I'm like,
Gustav Skarsgård? He's one of the Skarsgård brothers. I think it's Gustav. Oh, is it Bill?
Bill Skarsgård.
Oh, it might. No, but anyway, it's Floki.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. Well, hey, there you go.
Sorry, get back on your soapbox.
There's a connective universe between.
I'm just Vikings telling you that that is your best chance at convincing me to see that movie with
you. Yeah, you know what? I mean, he's gonna totally bring, you know, Ragnar out of, you know, the Derry.
It's
and
not true.
They're gonna both go fight the English in Derry. So yeah, being a fan of Stephen King's works, I had a lot.
I don't even know how to respond to that.
I had a lot of expectations for this film. I really was hoping and honestly praying that this film begins what could possibly be the heartbeat of every Stephen King film. The unique thing about the Gunslinger saga, the Dark Tower saga, is that once it was made, it actually, the entire series took over 25 years to finish. All 8 books. Stephen King actually got to book 6 or book 5, and he kind of put it on pause. It wasn't until after his accident that he had in 1999, he had a really bad car accident,
mm-hmm.
that it kind of catapulted him back into finishing that saga, which in turn, if you read through, which none of this has anything to do with the film, but if you read through the latter half of the,
all I'm saying is you are succeeding at filling time better than this movie did. I mean that as a compliment.
I appreciate it. Stephen King actually becomes a character in the latter half of the saga.
Of course he does,
and it ultimately comes to a point to where the main antagonist in the entire saga, which isn't the Man in Black, it's
right.
actually the Crimson King,
mm-hmm.
also known as the Fisher King.
No.
I was checking to see if you're paying attention.
No.
The Crimson King.
Not the same.
The Crimson King was actually the one who orchestrated the accident to have happened to the character Stephen King in the novels.
Oh.
So
he's basically like
meta real quick.
He's like exposing his own demons on the page.
Exactly.
Then is essentially what all that is.
Yeah,
interesting. It's a shame we won't actually end up seeing all of this play out, because I don't think it.
No, it's not gonna. It won't. It's there's no way in the world it's gonna stay on the same level as to where the book is.
It's too bad because. Well, I'm saying I don't know that it's gonna continue. I mean, they have to like.
Oh, you mean just as a franchise
force it.
Itself? Oh,
yeah. I think. If they can do whatever they're doing with the television show and that gets an audience and impresses people, then maybe mm-hmm. there's a chance. But I don't know with the movie. It didn't really, by the end of this film, it didn't really feel like anything. Like, it wasn't really myth-making. It was trying to be for a long time, but it didn't really quite stick the landing. well, it didn't stick the landing at all, in my opinion. And but then because it was trying so much to be myth-making,
yeah,
and to have this whole interesting like connective tissue thing with other properties. I mean, you do have a few, you know, little eye candy Easter eggs in the movie.
Oh yeah, there's a tons of stuff that, you know, we can kind of touch on in a little bit in terms of where the film actually hits on key parts of other films.
That just winks at you a little bit. If you're a fan, then you'll notice it, and if not, then it doesn't harm your experience of the film. But
no.
But still, it because it's spending a lot of time doing that and attempting at the myth making, it also doesn't work as, dare I say, your typical Stephen King film adaptation. Like it doesn't. It just doesn't feel to me. It didn't feel like anything at the end of it. It was just sort of like, I almost feel like I read somebody's book report and they didn't quite understand the book.
Well, and a lot of that goes to
the heart of the book. They understood like the action beats. This happened and then that happened, but the why was largely missing.
And that for me, I feel goes to the character development. Obviously, we're as the film opens, you're introduced to the main characters, which you have the young boy, Jake Tyler, I believe his name is.
Jake. Something like
something
that.
Something Jake. Jake something. And then you have the main protagonist, Roland Deschain, the gunslinger, played by Idris Elba. And you have the man in black, which is Matthew McConaughey. Jake Chambers. Sorry.
Chambers.
So you have Jake Chambers, you have the gunslinger, and you have the man in black. And mind you, individually, they seem like very strong individuals. They seem like very strong roles. They have the makings to be really great. Idris Elba has yet to not deliver on a role whenever he steps onto the
Agreed.
Screen for me. I have yet to see, even when he plays like, you know, not so great roles. Like he played one of the gangsters in American Gangster with Denzel Washington, mm-hmm. Russell Crowe,
mm-hmm.
and gets gunned down early in the film either way. But it's still a great role for him. I thought he was still outstanding in it. Everything that I've seen him do so far, I have yet to really kind of say, well, that wasn't a good part for him or that. The problem is when you take great characters and you take great opportunities and you squander them by not giving the actor or even the character full time to blossom. And not actually, I take that back, not even full time. If you don't invest in them to actually blossom on screen, then all you're getting is just one-dimensional characters who maybe they have really cool backstories, maybe they have really cool, you know, depth to them, but we didn't see it in this film.
Well, and I think some of it goes back to, if this truly is a bit of a hodgepodge of part of book one and part of book two and part of book seven and part of book three and part of something I made up because it helps to connect things. And all of this kind of the I guess the grain of salt in our posturing and pontificating is Stephen King himself did see an early cut of the film and gave it a thumbs up, you know, like, oh yeah, they did a decent job. I think by now he's got to be used to the whole dynamic of it's not going to be as good as the book. There's not enough time to cover all the ground that you can cover.
Yeah.
Even in half of one of his books. I mean, his books are pretty dense.
Pretty lengthy. Yeah.
Most of the time. And so, you know, he gave it his blessing and it's, you know, now been released to the masses to like or not. But looking at it just somewhat objectively, and again, as somebody who's not familiar with the source material, you know, what I got was Idris Elba is a phenomenal performer and should have had a lot more of that movie than he did.
Oh, yeah.
Because so much of the time is spent with the boy, Chambers, Jake Chambers. The character's name is Jake Chambers, because he's supposed to be your in to the whole fantastical whatever. He's the kid that lives in the modern day. He lives in New York City. He has these nightmares that he's kind of getting some psychological treatment for. He sees a psychiatrist and he's supposed to take medicine, I believe. And he kind of frantically draws the things that he sees in his dreams. And he insists that they are real, that they're in another dimension and they are going to impact our world at some point. And ultimately turns out to be right about that feeling. He's turns out to be a bit of like a psychic, essentially, a really strong psychic. And then he goes on an adventure and he ends up in the other, one of the other worlds and whatever. He meets the gunslinger. But really, in terms of the gravitas, the completeness of a character's story development and potential, it's the gunslinger. I don't know why you spend so much time away from the gunslinger. He is 10 times more compelling than everyone else combined in this movie.
Well, and he's the primary focus for all of the novels. Yes, King does make his appearance towards the tail end of the saga. And yes, there are other characters that roll in, like such as Jake Chambers. There's another character named Eddie. There's a girl. And they all come about as the books continue on. Like, I believe Jake and Eddie come about in the second book. And Jake's unique and whatnot. So, but needless to say, the fact remains is that these characters, this particular character is so dynamic, he should have been the primary focus for the entire storyline that ran through. And what's sad is that Sony actually had poor test screenings with this film. So when they started doing their test screenings to, you know, focus groups and whatnot to see what was going on with the film and how it's going to be received, I'm reading that Sony actually spent $6 million on reshoots just to help flesh out Idris Elba's gunslinger character.
I don't know why that. Why would you not have that? The books are all structured around that character.
The first book is called The Gunslinger.
Like, why would you not? That was the given. Like,
yeah.
That was the easy part of the test. Like, put your name on the paper.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that was that part of the test. How could you fail at that?
And then, I mean, like I said, there's only so much you can say about Idris Elba's character. I mean, he's, like we said, he's a great actor. He's a phenomenal person, I'm pretty sure. He probably could have acted circles around this role. Unfortunately, he didn't get...
Well, he does a good job. Like, he's, you can tell he is a solid performer.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he you can see in his time on the screen, like, the backstory and the subtext of every scene for that character is running through his mind. He's in character. He's not posturing and posing. Like, it seems authentic. Now, I'll shift gears for a second here. Matthew McConaughey,
oh boy,
on the other hand, I mean, you called this going into the film. You were really, really excited about the potential of seeing a villainous Matthew McConaughey, but you were concerned because the footage that we had seen in trailers and commercials and whatnot seemed to indicate that he was playing himself from the Lincoln commercials.
Yeah.
The car company Lincoln, not like a Abraham Lincoln or whatever, but the car company commercials. And that's exactly what this is. I mean, what the character is doing sometimes is menacing and diabolical and whatever. His demeanor and his just delivery of the character is so off. It just didn't feel... There was no Stephen King-ness to it to me.
Well, I mean, because...
As, like, this primary antagonist of the kickoff story, and your whole point is to say that even as bad as this guy is, he's not the ultimate bad guy. Oh, my goodness, you got to shake and quake in your boots. You got to wet yourself. You got to have nightmares and terrors about then what in the world is this Crimson King figure. Yeah, that's not the way you feel after meeting... and dealing with the man in black, because he's so nonchalant and almost bored.
He seems so
all the time.
And the problem is like the first interaction you have with the man in black in The Gunslinger, it's a retelling of what had happened in a saloon, in a bar. And like he walks in, the man in black walks in, and he very casually asks for a beer, and it's not even like the bar isn't even open to everybody else. It's actually a funeral going on in the bar. And he just walks right in and orders a beer, and they're like looking at him funky. And he's like, he literally goes up to him and is like, "You guys want to see a miracle?" And he slyly goes to the dead body, brings it to life, acts super maniacal, like not kooky monkey wise or anything, but he's like there's a laughter that comes out of him that's really, it scares the barkeep. There's a lot more dynamic characterization to this role.
And you're talking about the book.
And I'm
this
talking
does not happen
I'm,
in the
no,
movie.
No, this does not happen in the movie at all. But this happens in the book, in the very first book, in the very first iteration of The Man in Black. This is your first glimpse. Your first glimpse is this man who is unhinged, who has powers that you can't understand, and does things just for the sake of the fact that he can do them. But he recognizes what the terror that those acts have upon the people around him, and he thrives on that fear. Matthew McConaughey walked around and said, "You guys go wrestle. Die."
Yeah, he just like, he basically does this like slow saunter.
Yeah.
And kind of just like absentmindedly, randomly every once in a while says, you know, like, "Die," or "Stop breathing," or whatever. And they do. And there's no buildup. There's no tension to it. It's over so quickly, and nothing about his demeanor has changed. Like,
no.
He hasn't changed at all, and it really is kind of weird. It's a weird experience because it feels like you're watching the way he plays himself in the Lincoln commercials for, let's say 40 of the hour and 45 minutes, because he's not even in it that much.
And the problem is that,
and yet he's your primary antagonist.
Yeah.
And you're going to have a deliberate, massive good versus evil showdown at the end. But good wants to be good, but he's kind of washed up and, you know, not all the way, like his head's not all the way in the game for most of the movie. And then evil is like not even, he's barely, you barely even want to pay attention to him.
Yeah. And it's, here's the thing. And I was telling Chad this before the film started, and it still catches a lot of people off guard. I feel like Matthew McConaughey could play a really good villain. I really do. And here's my reason. The man's already a creep in most of those Lincoln commercials. He already plays a really eerie guy in mostly everything that he does. I mean, I actually liked his role in Frailty, which he does play a somewhat villain in that one. So for me, it would just play on the strengths that he's already portraying, in my mind, and I would think, okay, well, this will allow him to kind of fully flourish in that role he was meant to do. I mean, he could totally have gone like the whole, you know what I'm thinking? What was that movie?
Don't know what you're thinking. What are you thinking, Eddie? You're very excited about it.
No, I was just thinking, what was that movie about? It was something with dragons. It had Christian Bale.
Oh, right. I know what you're talking about. What's it called? Fire? Reign of Fire. Yeah, Reign of Fire.
He played Creepo in that one, and I could have expected that role in this film. I would have totally have seen it if he would have wore, obviously, the black suit, everything else black, but then just the depravity of how his mindset is of like, this is who I am. I am fire. I am death. I can do these things and blah, 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 yet still have that, you know, subtle Matthew McConaughey swagger, I guess, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, there's a difference between having a swagger and just being boring. You know, like you can be calm and menacing at the same time. Put somebody, here's what I'm thinking. This is right off the top of my head, so I know it's going to sound a little uncomfortable, but Man in Black, swap out Matthew McConaughey, put somebody like Kevin Spacey in there. He could pull off, not that I'm saying I'd rather see him as the Man in Black. He's just the first example that came to mind.
Okay.
He could pull off calm and menacing, and you would be intimidated by the crazy things he was doing with a straight face. Like telling people to stop breathing, and they stop breathing. But
true.
But the way he does it isn't, I'm bored about this. Like, and I think, honestly, I think it was a character choice. I think that it was a Matthew McConaughey and or the other creators behind this film adaptation wanted to tell a story of the Man in Black having done this for so long, like he just wants to kind of
be done with it.
Finish. Just be done. Yeah, like not be done with it in the sense of he wants to like retire to the beach and have a nice life, but he's just like, there's nothing interesting about all of this crazy stuff I can do anymore.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, he needs to have that hunger to go and influence other worlds that he hasn't yet influenced. And that piece, it's just, it's weird. It's,
and the thing is,
it's a disconnect.
That would make just about the right amount of sense if for not the fact that he finds this boy who has this unique ability and gets excited because he is the final piece to his, you know, huge puzzle that he's been trying to figure out, the last piece to figure out how to do what he's going to do. So you would figure that would ramp the dynamic emotions that he would be portraying as the Man in Black. And yet it was still very, very much Lincoln-esque, you know, commercial type Matthew McConaughey. There was still no, you know, bite to his fight. So it just,
I don't know. There's that poetry we were looking for earlier.
And honestly, the film is about, if you're understanding of the overall plot of the books or whatnot, the key thing to the entire film is the Dark Tower. The Dark Tower, according to the films and the books, is the central piece to the universe, to all the worlds in that universe. And if the Dark Tower falls, then the protective barrier that the Dark Tower creates will fall, and the creatures from the outside of the universe will attack all the worlds. So that's kind of the focus of the film. So Matthew McConaughey kind of wants to bring chaos and death to the world. The gunslinger just wants to fight.
And he's the last of his kind, so he's pretty washed up.
Yeah.
Kind of have to get him re-engaged, really, is the point of Jake's story, is to get the gunslinger re-engaged in the fight.
And, I mean, it's not like this film didn't have some parts that spoke to fans of the novels or fans of the saga itself, or even fans of just Stephen King's works altogether. I kind of geeked out a little bit, maybe too much, when in the beginning of the... Well, not even in the beginning of the film, within the first, like, 10, 15 minutes of the film, there's a part where the screen goes black, and the first line of the very first book is spoken in the film, and it pretty much says, the Man in Black wanders across the desert and the gunslinger follows. And so hearing that, it did get me excited. It's uniquely enough, that's the first line of the first book and the last line of the last book. So in its connection to the film at that moment, I don't know if it was really
well. And I think
relevant.
That's an issue that the film had holistically, is that for many Stephen King properties in particular, regardless of what kind of world it is, the thing that really characterizes and distinguishes it is this sense of the eerie. Like, there's something severely out of the ordinary.
Yeah.
In most of his works. Not all of them, but most of them. Most of the well-known ones. There's something severely eerie, and you have a kind of a table setting phrase like that, the Man in Black walked across the desert and the gunslinger followed. You have a tremendous opportunity to put everybody on the edge of their seats because it's eerie. That's not normal, you know, for somebody to be named essentially the Man in Black and somebody to be named essentially the gunslinger. You know, one pursuing the other across the desert. And then you get the whole thing with the Dark Tower. It anchors and serves as a hub for all the universe, all the different worlds of the dimensions of the multiverse. And you've got the creatures outside the universe that are demon-type creatures that are trying to break in and destroy everything. And, like, you've got a lot of potential there for eeriness and just way off. You've got a kid who's having psychic nightmares of death and destruction. I mean, the Man in Black is using psychic children, sucking all their life force and turning it into an energy beam to shoot at the Dark Tower. That is his strategy. That is his plan.
Yep.
And that's what he's doing. That's eerie, but for some reason, like, you see it on the screen and you're like, ooh, I need them to, like, just lean into it a little bit more. And they never quite do.
Well, and to kind of fully understand how much this film plays a pivotal role in the heart of all of these films, just with the film itself, some of the connections that are in there is, obviously, like I said, the Dark Tower itself is at the center of all of Stephen King's novels. It's the heart of the Stephen Kingdom, if you will. Obviously, in the film, if you've checked out any promotional information or whatnot, there is a Pennywise carnival sign, which is the creature from the movie It. And unbeknown to most people, It, the creature Pennywise, is actually an alien force that goes through into that actually goes into the world by something called a thinny. Now, a thinny, if you've seen the trailers, you see how people like travel through portals and whatnot. Those are weak points in the barriers between the worlds.
The trailers for the Dark Tower. The trailers for the new It.
So a thinny is actually a weak spot in the reality where the fabric of the worlds is worn thin. Simultaneously, if you've seen the movie The Mist, or like you mentioned, Under the Dome, all these creatures originate from breaking through a thinny. And there's actually a place where a lot of these demons are called, these creatures. Also in the film, you were talking about the psychic powers in his...
The Shine.
It's called The Shine, that's right. There's a character in the Stan novels. It's called Mother Abigail. She actually is one of the more powerful individuals who have the shine. In actually the Dark Tower novels, however, they call it the touch. When you transfer over to other places, they call it the shine. But it's actually a really big part of all of his novels in terms of having that shine, because even in the movie Stand By Me, the connection that those boys have, Stephen King has said that it is because of the fact that those boys have a shine that connects with each other. Also, like with the movie The Dead Zone, Carrie, Firestarter, even that movie Hearts in Atlantis. I don't know if you ever saw that movie.
I never did.
I saw it.
I mean, I'm familiar with, I remember the marketing stuff for it, but I never watched it.
And one other minor detail, the Man in Black is actually the same guy that is the antagonist in the movie The Stand. He's Randall Flagg in The Stand. He's the guy who's causing chaos and mayhem in the world and whatnot. So there's a lot. And mind you, that's just a little drop in the bucket of how much this movie, this property, plays a key pivotal role in the Stephen King novel and cinematic universe.
But only if you let it.
True.
I don't think this movie opened any of that. Okay, so you have a rundown carnival ride with the word Pennywise over it in a dark forest where something potentially scary is going to happen. That's not really, that's an Easter egg. That's not, oh wow, it's all connected. Like, you need somebody telling you that from the outside. And I think if we didn't have the Cliff Notes version of this movie, you wouldn't necessarily have to have somebody on the outside tell. Like, I think there's a more sophisticated way that this thing could have been pulled off.
Oh,
and
no
I don't
doubt.
Know what it is, because I haven't read the books, so I don't have the answer. I don't have the magic bullet. But it's very obvious. Stephen King is a brilliant guy. Like,
oh, without a doubt.
Brilliant guy. And all the things that you just said just make me sit here and think, oh, how clever. Oh, how clever.
Mm.
You know, it doesn't mean I like every aspect of every book he's ever written or every movie that's been made about those books or TV shows or, you know, whatever. But it's extremely, exceptionally clever to find some kind of a way to shoehorn everything in together into one stream of storytelling over, what, 50 years?
Yeah.
Of professional work. That's phenomenal. That's extraordinary. And it gives the filmmakers here a lot to play with. I think that they probably got a little too intimidated by how much there was, and they just dumbed it down too much.
And that makes a lot of sense. In the once you see the film, it makes a lot more sense. Like, obviously, like I said, I've been a fan. I did all this research. I checked these things out because I wanted to make sure. I mean, that, like I said, and this information is a drop in the bucket compared to how much the overall connective universe works out for the novel side, as well as some on the film side. But it is kind of a dropped ball on the filmmaker's part for this. I mean, this is all great information, and being able to utilize that information and create the beginning web of what could be the, like I said earlier in the show, the new Stephen Kingdom, if you will, the new cinematic universe for Stephen King. Because we have this film this month, we have the next film coming out next month. I mean, what's to say that somebody doesn't come back and do another, you know, Salem's Lot, or another Firestarter, or another, you know, bringing back all these films that play key roles in all of these. I mean, I am totally down for a whole new Tommyknockers movie. I mean, the Tommyknockers was such a great film. Aliens and superpowers and all that kind of stuff. It was fun. But this type of thing, this type of product that you get when you have a really great work like the Dark Tower saga, and you end up with something like what we saw, it really kind of begins to start diminishing the hope for what could be.
Well, and here's the thing. Number one, I would be talking a completely different game if this experience of the Dark Tower, what we saw as a movie, if this instead was the first like 2-hour premiere of a Dark Tower series, it would be totally different, because that's what this movie does. It tries to almost coyly set up, tries to set up a lot of plot points that are going to pay off later down the road.
Yeah.
The problem is with a feature film like this, with stars of this caliber and a budget of this size and magnitude, you have to tell a good self-contained story, even while you're launching into, you know, this almost like, you know, mini-headed Hydra monster of a property, right?
Yeah.
You still have to have beginning, middle, end, and it feels good and complete, and you're ready to move on to the next installment. This one does have a beginning, a middle, and an end. I just would argue it's not all that compelling. It feels rushed, and it feels, you know, not really fully developed, which is insane considering what they had to work with. I would feel totally differently if this was the first, you know, 2-hour installment to kick off a new series on television. I think I would feel a lot better about it, even though it would still be rushed and not have a lot of character development, because you know that, oh, well, that stuff starts kicking in next week. You know, here, like, when does that stuff start kicking in? Ever? Do we know? Does it depend on how much money it makes in the box office? Yeah, I don't know that Sony knows the answer.
And it's so true that you say that this could totally work as the beginning of what could be a possibly huge television series. Because if we take a look at, just kind of for example, Man in the High Castle, that first pilot was phenomenal. And it drew you in, and it left you literally on a what the heck kind of moment, where you're like, wait, no. And after what, it was like an hour and 45 minutes? It was a long pilot.
Yeah, I mean, it's not any longer than this movie. I mean, it's not.
Yeah, and it totally left me wanting to know more, wanting to be invested. Even though you only had so much time with the characters, it was still more than enough to want to know, man, this is a universe I want to invest more time in. I want to know what's going on here. I want to know why this character chose to be this, why that character chose to do that. And in this film, it was like, oh, this was just a one-off. You know, this could have, and I know this doesn't say much well for the film, but this could have easily been like a YouTube video or anything, just like a kind of drop in the bucket. Like, oh, yeah, here's my fan-made film of this. It's not going to go anywhere. It's just, you know, I'm trying to do something, you know, to show off my skills. So I don't know. I would have loved for this film to been more than what it was, but So with that said, Chad, how many monocles and does it pass or does it fail?
Well, I do my best to be a nice person.
Oh boy.
And I like to respect the things that people do well.
Oy vey.
But there just wasn't that much in this particular movie that I found all that compelling or appealing. I would give Idris Elba like a 4 out of 5.
Ever since last week when you started splitting hairs.
But I can't rate it just on him because they didn't give enough of the movie to him. They should have. They absolutely should have. But they didn't. I would probably... It doesn't pass for me. This movie was a fail for me. The way it started, there was kind of... You and I were talking right before we started recording the episode. There was this almost like these musical cues in the beginning that were like, oh, I get it. This is like modern world and kind of like a mythological, almost like a Lord of the Rings, like mashed up, and it's going to be epic and it's going to be amazing and dramatic. And then like nothing really does that in this movie. Like it just doesn't go there. The music kind of tried to in the beginning, but then like it all just falls apart, which is a shame because I know that the director is a huge fan of the books. He really advocated to be on this film. Obviously had a lot of passion for it, but just the final product, for whatever reason, I don't know if it's studio interplay, test audiences, you never know why exactly, but it just doesn't feel like much when it's done. So it's a fail for me because I can see where it could have gone and it didn't even try. And I would give it Idris Elba. How much is Idris Elba's performance worth in this movie? I'm going to award... He's gonna get it a monocle and a half.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, well, a monocle and a half. It didn't work for me.
For me,
I almost fell asleep 2 times in this movie in 1 hour and 45 minutes.
Okay. It's gonna pass for me, but very little. Very by the skin of their teeth, they are barely passing for the sake of for the mere sake that this film tried to do something. It made all these mentions. There's a lot of connective parts that reference back. This is kind of like, I guess this is how a DC fan feels when they see the Batman versus Superman film.
Ooh.
It's like, oh, but you know, it had these great parts
now
from this film.
Now you've stepped in it.
And these great parts from this
now
film.
Now you have stepped in it.
I can feel you guys on this one. I get you guys. I totally understand because there were parts where I was like...
He just said, this is how a DC fan feels.
Because it's like, not everybody gets the references and you're like, but I get the references and it's cool, but it's like, it's only cool in my own little way. And, it's, you know, like seeing the picture frame on the psychiatrist's desktop and it's a picture of the Outlook Hotel, which is the same hotel from The Shining. And it's like, all those little things. It was unique enough to me to warrant.
You
a
can't
pass.
Make a movie based on all the Easter eggs.
I know, but they're making a Justice League. So.
I didn't need the sass or the odd cartoon voice.
So it's gonna pass barely.
How many monocles, Eddie?
I'm gonna give it 1.5. I am gonna give it 1.5.
How do you pass it with 1.5? That's not even 50%.
I gotta give grace. It
passes with 1.5 monocles?
Okay, I'll give it a 2. 2 monocles, that's it.
It passes with 2 monocles?
It passes with 2 monocles. I can't help it.
I wish I would have had you as a teacher.
let us know what you think.
Oh, you got a 25%. I'll give you a C+.
let us know what you think about this film. If you agree with Chad, drop a comment in the Facebook post for it. Sorry, I'm getting all discombobulated. If you agree with me, let me know. Show me some love and let's hear your thoughts.
Pass or fail. Pass or fail.
Yeah, so, but yeah.
Noting that there's only half a monocle between our scores.
Truth. and the film is in theaters now, so go ahead and check it out if you want, and we'd love to hear your thoughts. Before we go, we're going to leave you a little bit of movie news and the announcement that has changed the face of movie streaming at home.
It's changing the world.
It is. Disney has announced that it will create, wait for it, its own streaming service.
Oh, I thought there was going to be like a sound effect or something. I'm like, what am I waiting for?
Oh, there's always a sound effect somewhere hiding. Back in 2012, Disney struck a pretty huge deal with Netflix to provide new releases exclusively to the streaming service. But in an earnings call today, Disney CEO Bob Iger announced that Disney will discontinue this practice and launch its own streaming service in 2019, which will host a plethora of Disney movies and Disney-owned television series aimed at kids. So ultimately, if you've been watching Moana on Netflix for the last couple of months, get it in as much as you can. Watch Moana as much as you can because you have until 2019 and then they're pulling the plug.
Well, here's the thing. And again, I didn't do my homework. I'm pretty sure as much of a big deal as has been made of this like earnings call and the announcement, they're going to break up with Netflix and make their own service. Who knows how much it's going to cost. It's going to whatever they want to charge, they can, because people are going to try to eat all of the Disney content up as much as possible. Like, they said this years ago when they did the Netflix deal. I'm pretty sure I remember them saying, eventually we want to start our own thing, but right now we're not going to do that. We're going to, you know, release everything to Netflix first and then figure out the best way for us to launch our own streaming service. I don't think that this is really new news. It's just a confirmation that they're ready to pull the trigger.
I don't know. I think this is one of those things that kind of caught a lot of people off guard because of the fact that change never sits well with anybody. And this is one of those big changes where now, along with Netflix, now you're going to have to pay for Netflix, Amazon Prime, Hulu, and Disney. So I think that's...
Everybody's doing it, though. You have to pay for HBO as a separate add-on to Amazon, Stars,
true,
Showtime, CBS All Access gate checks and maintains their own whole separate thing that you've got to do. Like, it's not really... Everybody wants a piece of the streaming pie because eventually that's where it all goes anyway. Everything's going to the cloud. So, you know, same way that cable revolutionized the way that people paid for and took in, you know, broadcast over the airways content, that streaming is doing the same thing.
I don't know. I mean, I like the idea of the fact that all of the Disney content, which includes all the Marvel content as well as the Star Wars content, all of that will kind of converge into one easily accessible place. I just think it's going to be kind of one of those things where this may very well, and I'm maybe calling it right now, might be just be blowing smoke out of the back of my head, who knows, but this in my mind is kind of predicting the doom that will come about with Netflix soon, unless Netflix begins to keep picking up their game.
Conspiracy theories.
I think they're kind of hanging by a string there, and there's been rumors within the last couple of months about, you know, them being in the hole and being in debt, and they just acquired a brand new comic book company, Miller World, and you know whatever that's going to bring about. I'm pretty sure it costs money to purchase them, and I don't know.
You gotta spend money to make money, my friend.
Well, let's hope that they make money on this one.
Well, they don't really release much about their
earnings or whatnot,
outgoing or incoming cash flow, so it could be the total opposite of what, you know, the naysayers are saying. I don't think it is, but it could be. They're very secretive on the whole about what money is going where. And they have been financing new projects all over the world for several years now for exclusive content that only appears on Netflix. So it just depends on the quality of what they're producing. Some of it's quite good. I mean, we've seen some of the Netflix series from other countries watched it with subtitles and everything. I mean, it's really compelling stuff.
What was that one we saw that one time? 2% or 11%?
3%.
3%.
Yeah. The Brazilian one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That
was good.
Really cool. But yeah, well, that about wraps up another awesome episode of The Filmlosophers. Remember, you can check us out on our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmlosophers or on our Twitter page at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. We'd love to connect, so drop us a line on either of those accounts. This was a great conversation. This was super fun, even though, you know, the film had its own unique touch, if you will, on each of us. It was still worth talking about. And hopefully, if you get a chance to see it, we'd love to hear your thoughts on it as well. Before we go, I'll let you know a couple of upcoming weekend releases. You got Ingrid Goes West with Aubrey Plaza. You have The Glass House with Woody Harrelson and Brie Larson. And you have Annabelle Creation. So...
Which yeah. You almost got a chance to see.
I almost did, but sleep overcame, and I was just ready to go to bed. So, yeah, Comic-Con stuff. We'll talk about it later. But from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Chad.
Class dismissed.